Part 3. What they took from Mord and from us. A few days after we cast Born out, Mord lost the power to fly. Whoever had taken that away from Mord must have hoped it would happen in mid-glide over the city, and that he would plummet from a great height and die in an ocean of his own blood. But it did not happen that way. He just woke up one morning and could not fly. Was this a relief? It should have been. But somehow, it seemed foreboding. A sign along with all the other signs that the things we depended on were changing. Mord sat in the apocalyptic splendor of his own fur across the cement of an empty parking lot, surrounded by his huffing, grunting, snorting proxies, and he could not fly. He could not float or soar or hover, though he tried. Such puzzlement in Mord's snarls, these snarls like hissed out question marks, and then the titanic bellow to follow that expressed in heavy breath his rage and his outrage. Mord could not fly, and a dozen cults across the city must have collapsed and their followers fled in confusion or disbanded or killed themselves. God was God no longer. God would have to walk the earth like the rest of us. He had lost something he had come to believe he would always have and relied on to be there, and its absence came as a shock. Still, Mord tried to become a god again. He hurled himself at the sky, only to lurch and stumble and catch his balance with his front paws smashing against pavement. Drawing himself up to full height, attention to his body, as if with every muscle tightened he could will himself into the air. He stood there while the Mord proxies milled underfoot in a chorusing "duck, duck" of confusion. Mord tried again and again, offering himself to the sky, each time rejected, no matter the method. A full running start on all fours, a cautious expedition from the top of a three-story building crumbling beneath him even as he jumped from it. Another run, this time on his hind legs, but to no avail. Half a morning spent by the great bear, launching himself, seeking to recapture the magic, to restore the company tech that had allowed him to ease his great bulk through the sky. He took to what came instinctual again, bounding on all fours through new wreckage and old, smashing everything in his path, splintering houses, collapsing smokestacks that fell out to the side like paltry straws. No matter. Mord was trying to achieve an escape velocity he'd never had or needed, and came rough tumbling back down after a handful of breath-catching moments when it appeared he had once more achieved separation from the ground. When there could be seen a space between his belly and the earth, his paws and the earth, only for it to prove an illusion. And he fell, sometimes heavily, to bruise bones and muscles with an impact that leveled a courtyard or apartment complex. From the dust clouds of such destruction, Mord would rise, staring toward the horizon as if it held some answer. But mostly, as he came to accept this new limitation on his powers, Mord sat. Mord sat and pondered. Mord sat and pondered and swiveled his great head from side to side, surveying his domain, curious as to who would be the first to challenge him in his reduced condition. Mord looked as if his brain was full of murder, because he recognized what was to come. And he was ready. But he also looked like a bear cub, left to fend for himself amid the huge pile of bones that was the city. I had seen Mord hungry and thirsty. I had seen him possessed of a secret anguish. I had seen him injured, favoring a paw or a muscled shoulder. But I had not seen him with his back to the wall, or desperate or mortal. No one had. And yet we were about to, a fear and opportunity both. The perverse question in that city for all of us was what would bind us together were Mord ever to die? "The magician's back," Wick told me. "The magician must be back." "Is that it?" I replied, although I had little interest. Wick still had a nose for information, even as his contacts thinned. Among the rumors that came to us in the days after, that some of the magician's people had infiltrated the company building, had gotten through the gauntlet of proxies, had flipped a switch or destroyed a mechanism, and this was the source of Mord's diminishment. Others believed Mord's earthbound status was a time-delayed effect of his mauling of the company building, which had damaged a mechanism that had finally given out, or a sign that his cult, within the company, had lost faith in him. Whatever the truth, what did I care now whether Mord did or did not fly? I had suffered a terrible shock and an absence that could never be made right. This was the city, and we had to go on like it didn't matter, could not show weakness, or we were lost. All that mattered, like Mord on a smaller scale, was making the effort to look around me to see what might next come at me in my new weakness, my time without Born. As the days passed, and it became clear that Mord would never fly again, a sound we did not know we had been hearing removed itself from the city. A sound like a secret manipulation of the air. Something that left so little trace, I find it hard to describe, because it had been a sound so invisible, so smooth, so without texture or taste or smell, that all we knew was that we missed it now, even if we could not recall its nature. But this I knew in my gut. It had been the sound, the underlying subliminal hum, that meant Mord could fly. I thought of Born and his extra senses. I thought of the company and Mord, and I wondered what else in this city we could not hear, would only hear when it was taken from us. Faint but powerful evidence of the magician's rebirth came to us much closer to home. With a regretful look, Wick told me to go to the northernmost balcony cliff's exit and see what now lay beyond it. I knew Wick wanted to distract me, to relieve the ache of Bourne's absence, and to force me out of the emptiness in my head, or otherwise he would have just told me. But I went anyway. Outside the northern exit, the magician, or someone, had gathered the three dead astronauts Wick had discarded there, dug them open graves, put one body in each, and put a name on a piece of wood by each. Wick, Rachel, Born. Along with a word scraped out in the dirt with a stick. Leave. The magician's intel was out of date. If she was back, and this wasn't the doing of her underlings or some third party. There were only two of us now in the balcony cliffs, and it seemed far emptier than that. But mostly, when I saw the graves, I decided the magician was not a serious person. Until then, even though we were enemies, I think I had at times given her too much credit, taken comfort in the idea that she represented some kind of hope for the future of the city, and that after bloodshed and despicable acts might come peace or stability. As I stood there, a familiar fox appeared from behind a pile of cinder blocks nesting in the moss nearby. But she wasn't really a fox. In that clear light, she looked like clever, abandoned biotech. I thought I could see tiny vestigial arms beneath the fur of her chest. The darting of her gaze was too human. "Tell the magician she can fuck off," I told the fox, although I did not believe the fox came from the magician. If anything, the fox came from Born. Or I hoped the fox came from Born. The fox gave me a look I suppose I was meant to interpret, but signs and symbols did not interest me. "Go away," I said. The fox cocked her head, appraised me, let out a yip. "Go away," I said again. The fox did something with fur that clearly wasn't fur, but some trick of bioluminescence to resemble fur, and slowly faded, bit by bit, until she had indeed gone away, but only by disappearing in front of me. I thought I heard the pitter-patter of paws receding. Had she always known how to do that? Or had Bourne taught her? Something in me was tired of how the dead astronauts kept switching their allegiance, of the way these bodies kept being disrespected, had no fixed address or location. In truth, I didn't want to ever see them again. So I took the time. I went back inside, found a rusty shovel, came back out, and buried them in those graves. Tossed the placards away, rubbed out with my boot the word "leave," and said a few words over the ground, which I tried, with moss and pine needles, to make as anonymous as possible so no one would know anyone had been buried there. "Be at peace," I told them. "Be at peace now, and let no one recruit you for their stupid games." When I had first heard the story of the magician and the strange bird, it had struck me as somehow impressive or important, that it meant something. But it meant nothing, especially to a ghost. And that's what I was then. I was a ghost. I was a ghost. The lines had begun to fray and snap. The fireflies went out in my apartment. The toilet wouldn't work. We were down to 2 meals a day. I moved into Wick's apartment to conserve resources, but eventually his fireflies would go out too. Wrote Bourne in his journal. "I met a kind fox today. She was following me and I meant to eat her, but she wouldn't let me, although she apologized nicely. After we had talked for a while, I decided I didn't want to eat her anyway." Wrote Bourne in his journal. "My earliest memory is of a lizard pooping on me, and ever since I have hated lizards for ruining my first memory. But I also love them because they are delicious." Wrote Bourne in his journal. "The river isn't beautiful. It's toxic. It's full of poison. I sampled it, tested it. I'll never swim there, although I think I would like to swim. This entire city seems made to not let me swim anywhere. The river is poison, the wells are mostly dry, the company ponds are also toxic, no matter what the fox says, and the sea underneath us all dried up hundreds of years ago. I should like a real bath, like children get in books, in an old bathtub with the feet like creatures. What I need is a big bath, a long bath, bath, born to bathe, born to bath." Wrote Bourne in his journal. "I know that Rachel says killing is bad, and I know that means I must be bad because what I do sometimes is killing. But I cannot stop it, and it feels right, like breathing, and not like killing must feel, and I still can see them inside of me and talk to them, and they are still who or what they were before, even the lizards. So how can that really be killing?" Wrote Bourne in his journal. "It is hard to feel as if I am 2 or 3 places at once and have to concentrate on talking. It makes me sound like I don't know the meaning of my words." Wrote Bourne in his journal. "The world is broken, and I don't know how to fix it." When I could not find Bourne's journal after a time, I knew Wick had hidden it from me, and I did not mind, was almost grateful. I had memorized everything I could understand, everything in a language I knew. The journal itself did not matter. It could be taken away from me at any time, by anyone. What mattered is what I chose to remember. Bourne's absence had simplified something in the balcony cliffs. It simplified me and Wick, and this made everyday life duller or leached of some essential, stormy spectrum of color, made me think of myself as not quite alive. I often felt chastened and small and useless. But there was also the moment-to-moment relief of life being closer to what it actually was, with less pretense. Even this might have been an illusion. But everything is a kind of illusion in the end. We had to create passwords for our identities because of Bourne that we changed every day, every time we woke up or met each other in the corridor, any time we were parted by sleep or the demands of work. We lived in fear for a while of Bourne returning and taking up a disguise once more. They were silly things, the passwords, the only bright words amongst all the dull words. Most of them suggested by Wick, who made it like an extension of the games we played when I brought biotech to him. That I sometimes laughed because of these passwords only made the rest of my days duller. "Cheese, please," I would say to Wick.
"Goddamn oyster," he would reply.
"Rooster head."
"Mud skipper."
"Bear crap, bear print, bear bear."
"Magician, fester, cloak."
Silly. Very silly. But by these words, we knew we were real, that who we spoke to was real, even if I didn't feel real. Maybe I laughed because the passwords sounded like things Bourne would have said. Wick no longer talked about giving in to the magician's demands, even after the discovery of the graves. Something had changed in Wick with Bourne's absence and our togetherness, despite Bourne's absence, so that now her demands made Wick think more and more of the balcony cliffs as a fortress or redoubt against her. While for me, I would just do what Wick said and make the words come out of my mouth that supported Wick's vision, because I had no vision of my own. Work consumed us, thankfully. It drove most other thoughts from my head, and we welcomed that and we rejoiced, or at least I did. We could not predict the city, but we still had the balcony cliffs. We still had them. And we toiled once more to make the balcony cliffs ever more impervious to the scenting of random murder bears, labored unspeaking side by side at that hard work. The most ingenious was rigging the fireflies in our apartment, using pheromones. It had a time delay of about 30 seconds, but if anyone other than us tripped the bioreceptors at the entrances into the balcony cliffs, the fireflies on the ceiling would start to die out in clusters. Least ingenious, clearing the air duct above the bed as an escape of last resort. We were preparing for some catastrophe, the form of which we couldn't see. Because the networks and hierarchies had yet to become clear, and we had no real allies. Because the Mord proxies had learned to use tools. And Mord, vulnerable now, had become cunning, and deployed them more like a general ordering his troops. We took stock of food packets, even though I'd rather have eaten live insects than the runny, goopy, long-expired lumps in those packets. Chicken salad congealing, beef carrot stew. We had 23, which meant in terms of days, we had about 14. Rainfall had been intermittent and largely toxic, so our water supply extended a meager week beyond our thirst. From what Wick jury-rigged to collect from the morning condensation, we could potentially keep that week in reserve. From what Wick could cannibalize from the swimming pool, we could gain ourselves another week or two of food. If we included the remaining memory beetles, which had a particular crunch and a sourness that made them another food of last resort.
"Food packet or memory beetle?" Wick asked me, holding up one of each.
"Food beetle?"
"Not on the menu." Other things were back on the menu, though. The lizards had already crept back in, and the spiders, and I had witnessed three huge silverfish careening across a corridor floor, leaving a trail in the dust as if having a race. Every time I saw a living creature inside the balcony cliffs, I thought of Bourne. In our spare time, Wick and I sat side by side in a tunnel, in a room, in a corridor, shoulders touching, password protected. Was this you? Was that you? Was that Bourne? We were still reconstructing what we had actually said to each other, what he had not said, when I had not been there. As we removed the falsehood, as we built up the truth, damaged places became restored. Whole rooms inside flickered with at least a semblance of light, and we cast the intruder farther out into the cold. But I was not ready to cast out the intruder for good.